Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are Every Child, Fistula Foundation, Good Sports. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. Well, I'm trying to think how long ago it's been, maybe a couple of years ago. I did an episode with two amazing people, and I'll tell you how it came about. So I was doing an event at Columbia University with Darren Walker, the head of the Ford Foundation, and former mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter, on the charity sector or philanthropy and diversity, equity, and inclusion and the intersection. And can philanthropy really survive without greater diversity, equity, and inclusion? And themes around that. It was a great session. But anyway, after the event, this woman comes up to me. And you know how it is after you give a talk, if you've been in that position before. People come up and they say hello and they greet you and they want to get to know you a little bit. And they have additional questions that they want you to answer. And so this woman comes up to me and she's talking like a million miles an hour about this organization that she's involved in and how she's helping these people over in Ukraine and all this stuff. And finally, I say to her, you know, this is all fascinating to me, but I'm sure we're going to have to talk another time so I can get a full download of this, because she was giving it to me. I'm telling, she was dumping it, right? And so we schedule another time to talk. And I am just blown away. First of all, she happened to have been at the time a student at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, getting a master's degree. I think it's public administration, actually, getting a master's degree. She was a student, but yet at the same time, she was taking trips over to Ukraine, helping young people who were in school in Ukraine from countries like Africa get situated after the war broke out. And I'm like, how are you doing this? And so then she tells me, well, I have a partner who I work with. His name is Nassim. And she and Nassim Ashford organized this company, this nonprofit called Noir United International. And the mission was really to help people who are from disadvantaged communities, but in international places when they need help. And they've been doing it. How do you do this? First of all, you're still in school, but they're doing amazing work. And so we had I had to get them on a podcast, and I did. And you should listen to that show if you haven't heard it. It was an amazing show, just talking about what they were doing and planning to do a couple of years ago. So now we have them back. Nassim Ashford and Masiri Aribo are both here. And there's a lot that's happened since the last time we talked to them. One thing is that they have gotten married, which is kind of a cool thing, you know. The second thing is they both graduated from graduate school. Nassim graduated with a master's degree in public health from Yale University. And Masiri got her degree at Columbia from SEPA. And so they did all that. And they told me at the time, you know, we have some footage of information that we've been capturing from the trips that we've made over there. And, you know, we'd like to put together a little video of it. So I said, you know, you should check out my guy, Thad Housley, who is the engineer for these podcasts. And he can probably help you. So little to my knowledge, they've been working behind my back to put this thing together. And Thad told me that it's something like, I don't know how much, we'll find out. Anyway, let me stop talking. Welcome back, you two. What's going on? Tell me what's happening with you. Nassim, what's going on?
I'm doing good. I'm glad to be back. We're glad to be back. Like you said, it's so much has happened in the last year plus since the last time we were able to be on the show. And just we're happy to be here. Thinking about everything that we've been able to do so far, it's only when you're able to talk to others and share your story and give updates that you really understand your impact and what all you've been able to accomplish. And that's how Masiri and I feel. When we first started off on the journey of creating this documentary, we didn't really know where to start. We just had an idea. Masiri and I traveled back and forth to Europe more than eight times now, actually. But at that point, eight times, recording and documenting stories of African and other third country nationals who were fleeing the war from Ukraine. And for us, we just wanted to not only showcase what was happening, but give people an opportunity to speak for themselves and to let their voices be heard so that others can understand how this situation not only impacted Ukrainian nationals, but others who were living in the country as well. All in an effort for us to promote this idea that we've been talking about and interacting with other humanitarian organizations with, but the idea of humanitarian equity, ensuring that different crises around the world, different disasters, both man-made and natural, happen, we must make sure that the resources are distributed equitably amongst community members. And we have to ensure that people are protected so that as they continue to move on with their lives, they'll have some form of resiliency so that they can continue to build and be a functioning human being. And so the docuseries that we've created essentially is a combination of all of that. We try to spotlight on different individuals through different lenses to not only showcase their story, but to shed light onto what actually happened throughout this entire war.
Wow. So Masiri, have the stories helped us better understand the extent to which that aid is being distributed equitably or not?
Well, first, thank you, Art, for bringing us back here. I think to answer your question about what these stories entail, the stories, they definitely showcase the experiences of students starting from when they first learned about the war, from how they started their escape plan to leave Ukraine. And it goes on to showcase the journey that they had once they finally left Ukraine and went to Europe, throughout the rest of Europe, in Poland and Germany and Hungary and France. And I think what you'll learn from these stories is that there is definitely an injustice that's happening. And when you think about the different policies in place, how immigrants or migrants have been treated in Europe and how that has been impacting the way that people are able to access resources, social services, different kinds of support that was available or made available to Ukrainian nationals and not necessarily other Black and brown refugees who have been displaced from war, it just goes to show and goes to highlight how it's important for us to be centering these stories and centering these experiences. And there's definitely a great need that's still there, a great need for access to education, which was the number one priority for many of these students. If you recall, many of them were in Ukraine studying to get their master's degree, studying to get their doctorate degree, studying to get to become doctors, lawyers, things like that. And that's still a dream that should still be in reach for them, but it's difficult because of the different systemic barriers that are in place and because of the categorization of them being third country nationals in Europe rather than being considered refugees.
So what's it mean to be a third country national, Nasim? I mean, from what you told me before, and I don't know if it's still the case, some of them had trouble going back to their country of origin because they were told not to leave in the first place. And by leaving, they sort of lost out on the right and ability to come back. Is that still true? So what is the true penalty and the risk that they had to endure leaving their country to seek education somewhere else?
So I would just start off by saying everyone's situation is different. And the more we interacted with different individuals, we learned and understood how complex this situation is. Legally, third country nationals defines a person who is not a Ukrainian citizen. So to put it in context here, that could be someone who is on a worker's visa, someone who's on a student visa, someone who's visiting the country temporarily. So anyone who does not have their permanent Ukrainian citizenship. And so because there were so many people who were living in the country of Ukraine when the war first started, each of them living in Ukraine, depending on how long they lived there, we've interacted with people who lived in Ukraine anywhere from a few months to 20 plus years living in Ukraine with these different statuses that define their legal situation within the country. And so when you look at the risk for them leaving the country initially, there were many different forms of communication that were going around. And I would say that from what we heard from the students directly was that because of the uncertainty of the countries knowing whether or not Russia was actually going to invade the country, the country's representatives, as well as the school representatives, told the students, you don't have anything to worry about. It's okay. Keep going to classes, pay your tuition fees, which is another issue that we continue to see over and over again. But they tried to give them the feeling that everything was normal and that it was going to be okay. However, we know that that was not the case. As originally, when people were trying to leave the country, it was difficult for them to access the forms of transportation that were available to everyone inside the country, being the buses and the trains. People faced discrimination while trying to leave there, as well as once they got to the borders, they were segregated at the borders between whether or not they were Ukrainian or whether or not they were a third country national. So this third country national status actually had real world impacts on individuals as they were trying to navigate this situation. And I would say that the status also further disenfranchised them as they were living in Europe and other countries within the EU. As they're trying to access services such as housing or such as food and even medical support services, it was difficult for them to engage with those institutions because they did not have the Ukrainian nationality. And so even saying all that still, because these individuals made their life in Ukraine, a lot of them saw that it was better for them to go back into Ukraine versus being in Europe with no support at all. And so we had a large case of people who were going back into Ukraine to live there and to essentially wait out the end of the war. And so one of the things that we've been working on since the beginning of this the whole situation is just advocating and just trying to explain that situation so that people can understand how legal situations create these massive barriers that people have to navigate in order to rebuild their lives over again. Millions and millions of funding has been raised for this situation. And for the people on the ground, those who are the individuals that may not have had access to that, those fundings or to those resources, they're now still in the same situation, given the fact that they've already put up so many resources personally, family resources, in order to move to the country. And now since leaving the country, they've essentially been left with no support.
So Masiri, help me understand and our listeners understand, why would someone leave their country to get an education in Ukraine? Because it's not going to be intuitive to everyone to understand the nature of what drives that, right? So tell us about why people do it. It's not strictly based on academic reasons, right? It's based on a whole host of reasons. And when they do it, I guess the big question is, once they do it, what do they give up?
So the reason many people leave their home country to go to Ukraine is, I mean, one, it's economic. It can be based on safety. And it's just about the lack of opportunity within their own home country. So many of these students come from various places throughout the African continent. And when you understand the history of the African continent and the history of colonialism, the history of how that has disenfranchised the different systems that were in place, perhaps to provide education and provide support, that is one of the reasons why many students seek educational opportunities outside of the continent. And the legacy of people leaving the continent and going to Ukraine, I mean, it dates back to the Soviet Union. Back during the Soviet Union, when they were trying to increase their influence on the continent, one of the key things was to provide education to students. And that was providing scholarships for them to study and perhaps return back to their home country or remain there in the Soviet Union to contribute to that economy as well. So the option of, you know, being able to pursue your education in another country was always something that was attractive to young students on the continent, because if you don't have electricity, you're not able to do your homework assignments. If you don't have enough school fees, you won't be able to pay for a quality education. And so going to school in Ukraine was much more affordable for many students in comparison to going to the United States or going to the UK or other places in Europe. And I think that it's important for us to recognize this context, because many of these students don't just leave for fun or leave because they want to experience a new thing, like how many of us in the United States may go to study abroad somewhere. People are doing this out of a sake of their livelihoods, for their families. I remember one of the stories that I had heard when we were there, one of the students that we worked with told me about how he had sold everything so that he could go to Ukraine, so that he could study and pursue his education. And he left about 7 siblings and his mother and father back in their home country, in Guinea, actually. And they were all depending on him. They were all depending on him to fulfill his educational goals and desires, get a job, and come back and use that income to support their family and perhaps support his siblings in getting an education. So it's, everything is like a ripple effect. It is people depend on one another to support their livelihoods. And when you remove the access to education, you're removing people's livelihoods and their ability to contribute economically to their families, contribute economically to their communities, and to the country overall. And so when you speak to many of these students, they'll say, well, my goal was to get my degree, come back and build something in my community, because I have so many friends, so many family members who have so much potential, but they don't have the ability to tap into that potential because of lack of opportunity on the continent.
So the next question for me is, what happens to them? So they're in Ukraine. Are they still going to school? What's the situation for many of them right now, Masiri?
Right now, many of them are, you may have a case of some students who have been able to continue school in Ukraine, so they might be doing online school. We work with a group of over 500 students who were in Poland who were able to transfer to a satellite school that campus that they had. That was the Kyiv Medical University. They had a campus in Katowice, Poland. So many of them were able to continue their education there. And some others have been fortunate enough to transfer to a university in Spain or in Portugal, in Germany. And so there are different cases of where people have been able to find solutions to the challenges that they're facing. But what I will say is that for the majority of people, because of that legal barrier, because they are not able to receive temporary protection, which would allow them to be legally in the country for perhaps 2 to 3 years, then if you don't have access to that, you aren't really able to plan for your life. So that causes challenges with accessing education, getting a job, accessing employment, and just meeting your needs in general. So for some students, they are reliant on either the community of support around them, grassroots organizations that have emerged to support these students. And these are grassroots organizations that we have also been able to work with through our own network that we developed there. And also through the support of Noir United, we've been able to support people who needed to cover their rent, needed to cover their semester school fees, different community support that has been there for them. But for the most part, students have been on their own trying to figure out how best to accommodate this situation.
So Nassim, what's it mean to be on your own? So are they able to work if they're in Poland or Ukraine? How are they making a living? If let's assume they're not in school. Assuming if you're in school, you got, at least by American standards, some degree of security with housing and money to cover your tuition and maybe some money to deal with meals and that kind of thing, at least here. Is it the same there? What's going on? And for those who aren't able to stay in school, what's going on with them? Because they're not there on that kind of program, right?
Mm-hmm. I would say the situation for those who are on their own are by far the worst out of everyone that we've dealt with so far. First, I would say, just thinking about the average standard of living, where you know where you're sleeping, you know you have something to eat, you wake up every day and you have a place that's safe. For those who don't have any support, some of them are homeless, living on the street, living in the tunnels and the trains around Europe. There's even situations where people reach out to us and they're obviously in desperate need. They have no food. And they said that they had only eaten things like bread and cheese for the last month or so. And so when we come across situations like this, we try our best to assist them. We have received funding in the past through grants. And so the grants have helped us to provide support to them. But once the grants ran out, now we're also in situations where we may have to tell someone, oh, we can't help you, or we don't have enough funding available to support you. And we try our best to support them, especially those who are in like very like critical situations. We have a few students that have been hospitalized throughout this entire process, and those who are in like more critical situations, we try to communicate with them more closely and work with them more closely. Outside of the grants, Miseri and I even give some of our own money to help them when we can. But other than that, I would say for those who don't have legal status and can't get a job or can't be in school, especially if they're not going back to their home country, they're in a really bad situation, honestly. For those who are able to get legal residency in the country that they're in, some jobs range from not even like stable jobs, like getting paid under the table, working in a bookstore, working in a restaurant, or ranging to factory jobs. So we had a few students that were working in chicken processing facilities in Germany, working in Tesla factory plants, building Tesla cars in Germany. Some of the students are very entrepreneurial, They've started their own businesses. So we have students that are women braiding hair or starting restaurant businesses, and or some students even try to help with the exchange of money, so sending money back home to others, family members and things like that. So I would say that the situation really ranges from individual to individual. However, without the necessary support, I mean, there are situations, especially over the last 2 years, we've seen it personally, it has not improved that much. And we talk to them pretty much still on a weekly to daily basis for some individuals, and their situations are pretty much the same.
Wow. Masiri, I want to just ask you again. I mean, we talked a little bit about this when we talked the first time, but why did you all get into this? I mean, you're just starting out your lives, your careers, really. I mean, you could be doing a lot of different things. What was it that drove you to get involved in this? I know you and Nassim have known each other since high school. Clearly, this couldn't have been your plan. What's going on? How did this happen for you? What was it about this situation that sparked such a need in you to respond?
Well, Art, I honestly love that question because it's an opportunity for me to also take the time to reflect on my why and why I decided to dedicate 2 years of my life to supporting students from Ukraine. And I think that the reason we got into this is because, I mean, one, Noir United, it was started back in 2020. It was during the global Black Lives Matter movement. And we were inspired by the fact that there was a communities around the world were coming together to advocate for equity and advocate for justice for Black people, not only in the United States, but all across the globe. And when you're founded with that kind of inspiration and you're also a student and you're going to Ivy League universities where you're meeting all these different actors and stakeholders, people at the UN, people at the World Bank, people at all these different prestigious institutions, you think to yourself, how can you utilize your environment around you, the resources around you to impact those who are less fortunate than you? And also thinking about it within the context of your identity. I'm a Black person. I'm African. And Nassim is a Black person. He's also Jamaican. And when you think about your identities and how you situate within the international system, within international affairs, global development, like what your role is there. I mean, your role is really to center your own experiences, the experiences of your community and the experiences that you can resonate with. So I think when we were at Columbia and at Yale as students, we identified with them because we were also students. We identified with them because we were also Black. And we identified with them because we also experienced racism, whether that be microaggressions in the day-to-day actions or the impact of the systemic racism that impacts your own life in ways that you may not necessarily be able to see. And when we saw this situation happening in Ukraine and having to reckon with the fact that even in the midst of war, your skin color can impact the way you're treated and your own access to safety, and that happening within modern day in 2022, I think that was something that we all had to sit down and grapple with. And when you see a situation like that, what do you do? Do you just write a letter and condemn it? Or do you take action and see how you can impact people all around you? And I think that was an opportunity for us to show that we as students, we may not necessarily have all the money in the world, but we as capable, smart students can actually make a difference in the lives of people around the world and actually use our voices and use our ability to support a population that would have otherwise been forgotten and never been considered within this whole context of the whole story of the Ukraine crisis. So when you think about Ukraine, a lot of times we don't think about the marginalized populations that were in Ukraine. So now that we've been able to go through this entire journey, we can think about Ukraine and remember the less fortunate people who had to face racial discrimination and the ways in which they had to overcome that as well. So I think that's the main reason why we decided to do this.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
I would like to talk about donation fraud, to provide some tips for you to have a fraud-free contribution experience. What are some things to keep in mind? First thing, watch out for deceptive drop boxes for clothing and other used items. If you see metal bins near, let's say, a retail establishment that you frequent that welcomes used clothing or other items, be careful. See if the organization's name is clearly labeled on the bin and find out more about that charity before you make a donation. Don't assume that everything that collects clothing in a metal bin goes to charity. There are sometimes actually for-profit businesses that may be out there welcoming donated clothing that have nothing to do with charity. So be careful. The other thing is, of course, watch out what's happening online. Look out for email messages that may include links and claim that they're linking to a favorite charity. This is especially true to be mindful of after a big disaster. Con artists are out there trying to get you to click without looking further in the hopes that they may be able to download a virus or access your personal information. If you really want to give to a charity that's engaged in a particular activity, go directly to their website. That's the best way to do it. Watch out when a con artist might be calling. Like any form of fundraising, telemarketing can sometimes be as a way to deceptively raise money from unknowing individuals. So if you receive a call for a charity that you've never contributed to before, I'd certainly encourage you to find out more about that group before making a gift. Don't be pressured to make an on-the-spot donation decision and give out your credit card or other personal information to a stranger. If you're really interested in the charity, they'll encourage you to give directly on their website so you can do safely as well as having an opportunity to check out the charity before you make the contribution. For more advice on giving and other contribution tips, visit our website at give.org.
Well, empathy and sadness and disappointment, all of those emotions can certainly drive someone to want to see change. But wanting to see change and actually doing something about it are two very different things. And Nassim, you all decided that you would do something about it. This is a highly complex situation. I mean, this isn't simply taking a few dollars out of your pocket and handing it to someone on the street who's hungry. What you're doing is dealing in a very volatile, complex situation, and brittle even. My futurist guru, Bob Johansson, just introduced me to a new concept. Brittle is kind of the world that we're living in today. And that's kind of what you're facing. It's like a chaotic situation for these people. There's no answer to how to solve it. But yet you guys felt that, nope, we're not going to let the complexity keep us from doing it, something about it. And you couldn't have known for sure whether the things you were doing would have any meaningful effect. How could you know? But you did it anyway. I'm trying to figure out, where does that come from? And how do you say, you know, all right, I can just finish out my grad school, go on with my career. What in the world was it inside of you two that said, nope, that's not enough? We're going to do something about this. What was that?
I would say that the idea of starting this organization, Nawari United International, did not come overnight. Masiri and I have been heavily involved in many different organizations and programs, such as her being a part of PPIA, which is the Public Policy International Affairs Program for undergraduate students. Myself, I was with the CDC CUPS, which is the Emerging Undergrad Professionals in Public Health Program. Both went to work on Capitol Hill at the height of the pandemic. So understanding not only how worldly factors are impacting our communities, but how policy also impacts our communities. And just seeing the real world impacts on how all of these different strings impact individual lives, I think was our biggest motivating factor to continue moving forward and to take this opportunity that we had in front of us seriously. And then I would say that the relationships that we've built along the way filled in that gap as well. And as we looked at this process of doing this entire project, we never saw it as we were going to fix the entire humanitarian space by responding to this particular instance. We more so saw ourselves as filling in a gap that was present. And we wanted to not only highlight this gap that was there, but we really wanted to address the gap. And this gap that we saw was not just here in this particular crisis in Ukraine, but we see this gap all over the world. We see this gap in Africa right now with the crisis that's happening in Sudan, which is the largest internally displaced population on the planet. It has the largest hunger population of people who are at risk of hunger on the planet. We have issues of what's happening in the Congo, where people are working in mines and don't have workers' rights and protection, and their livelihoods are being taken away from them as their country's resources are being extracted. All of these issues that we see, it's not just one person that can just come in and say, hey, I found a solution. We can put everything down now. We can keep it moving. But it takes a community of people to actively engage and to understand not only their role, but other people's roles as well, too, and to see how they can find a position in order to give back. And that's pretty much been our driving force, is just understanding who we are, where we come from, everything that's made us into who we are today, all of the opportunities we were given, all of the people that we've met so far. And we've tried our best to put that into the organization and to put that into the work that we continue to do in order to make an impact. And so I was just in saying that even though the challenges that are here that need to be addressed seem so big, it's in itself, it's not really as big when there's multiple different organizations and multiple different people working on a different aspect of it. And collectively, the work that's being done, that's the real impact. It's the collective work in the end. And so we view ourselves as a part of the collective in making that change.
Very good. Masiri, what do you hope the documentary will achieve?
I hope that this documentary will help people to understand the real world experiences of people who face displacement and the real world impact of war. A lot of times people are displaced by natural disasters, which we can't control. But war is something that impacts people in a very devastating way. And it's very hard for people to heal from that. You know, the episodes that we have, they focus on the impact of the war on education, the impact of the war on women, the impact of the war on advocacy efforts, and how people have had to go through different hurdles and hoops to try and reestablish themselves, to try and maintain the dignity and self-respect that they have for themselves, to try and make sure that they can be mentally strong enough to keep going, and rather than letting their circumstances stop them from achieving their dreams. I want people to see that we have a lot of commonalities despite us being in different locations. And I think that that was one of the key things that I took away from the docuseries and also from my own personal journey. Meeting people who were from all different kinds of nationalities across the continent and just seeing that they are similar to me in ways that I would have never even thought of before meeting them. We listen to the same kind of music, or we like debating about the same types of topics. We're interested in similar kind of things, and we're also have this goal of trying to better ourselves and better our communities. These are universal things that we can all align ourselves with and we can all, you know, identify with. And I think that the last thing that I would want people to take away from this is people should be thinking about how they can help, right? How they can make an impact on their communities and how they can learn and understand the different contexts and the different international issues that happen around the world and how we play a role and how we can play a role in that. And so I think that those are the key things that I think people should take away from it. And, you know, there's so much more that we can learn from one another and understand from one another just by taking the time to listen to people's stories and experiences and understand that.
Well, you know, we're out of time, but I want to give you the last word here, Nassim, today, and just ask, what do you hope others will do when they see the documentary?
I think the first thing that we would want people to do is to reflect. The last 4 years have been a really, really challenging time for everyone, not only thinking about the pandemic and how that changed our lives and thinking about loss, but it's also changed our lives in other ways, more, you know, on a societal level, politically, socially, economically. The last 4 years has really been a challenging time. And it's, I think that right now, when someone views this documentary, they need to understand that we as Americans, we as general people living here in our country, we're not alone. We're not in a vacuum. And it's important for us to engage and to truly understand what's happening around the world, to understand how we fit into that picture, into the puzzle. And after reflecting and seeing the videos and experiences of people, think about ways in which how they personally can give back to help and how they can really work with us to have an even bigger impact than what we've been able to do so far. And just to say that Masiri and I started this journey on our own, but through everything that we've been able to do, we have a whole family, a whole community with us now too. And everyone who's been on that journey so far has had the opportunity to learn for themselves, to reflect for themselves. And now we're all at a point where we've opened up ourselves to continue to provide a platform for those who would like to engage on issues that are happening around the world. And we're looking to open that platform and open up that opportunity to others as well to join us in this movement and to continue to have a sustained impact in the communities that we hope to serve.
Well, I want to thank you both for what you're doing and for the example that you're setting for others of us who care, but maybe haven't done as much as we might. Your leaders, your people who we should follow, people who we should hear from. And I am more than impressed. Impressed doesn't even cover how I feel about the two of you. It's pride. It's just a sense of my happiness that I could even be connected to you. I know that whatever you're doing today, however great it is, there's so much more you're going to be doing in the years ahead. And I just am very happy about that. I feel it gives me a sense of optimism that you're out there doing what you do and shedding the light on opportunities for others to engage and shedding light on areas where there's a lot of darkness right now and needs that light. So you've been listening to Nassim Ashford and Masiri Aribo, and they are the co-founders of Noir United International. And their website is noirunited.org. And on May 25th, which is World Africa Day, their docu-series will premiere. So I hope that all of you will tune in to gain access to this docu-series, which will be on YouTube, and you can find it through their website, noirunited.org. So definitely do that. Now, for all of you who are new to the podcast, this is a weekly show. I hope you'll subscribe. That's how we get attention, just by people subscribing, so that we can continue to bring you amazing guests like Nassim and Masiri. And we'll hope to see you back here again next week for another episode.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.